You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
I'm Brian Hyatt from Rolling Stone, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I have with me today Brittany Spanos and Andy Green from Rolling Stone. And, oh yeah, I also have with me Tegan and Sarah right here in the studio.
Oh, hi. Oh, hi. It's like the way you describe that, it's like we just popped out of your bag. Like, you're like, I brought my friends Tegan and Sarah from home.
Yeah, before I leave the house, I'm always like, I got my phone, I got my keys. Do I have Tegan and Sarah? And like,
yes. That's smart. Everyone should think that
you
way.
You should get those tile things for us and just put them in our pockets.
Oh, yeah, the finder.
Yeah.
So yeah, thanks for being here.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having us.
So I wanted to start on the most random point possible, which is
great.
Tegan, you have two tattoos of the lyrics of Bruce Springsteen's Human Touch.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
True fact.
True fact. And which lines are they, and which arm is which? You're wearing a lot of clothing, so we won't ask you to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
you know. It's Rolling Stone. I thought this was radio. I had to dress like a pop star today.
I have What You Don't Surrender, The World Just Strips Away.
Yeah. And I will say that I love that song, and that song means a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's also like a kind of an uncool Bruce Springsteen song.
Don't get out of here. You're fired from the podcast. From the radio.
It's, you know, it's a period that some people like deride, and it's not, but I mean, it happens to be great. And I'm just curious, like, what is it about that song and that lyric that...
Well, in order to answer your question, I have to broaden the question to more like just Bruce Springsteen in general. And, you know, Sarah and I grew up in a Bruce Springsteen household. My stepdad, who came into our life when we were six, his name is Bruce, and he was obsessed with Bruce Springsteen. We listened exclusively to Bruce Springsteen. Every once in a while, we take time to listen to U2. But yeah, we had like framed, giant, lit photographs of Bruce Springsteen in our entryway at our house. And so I have a deep love for Bruce Springsteen. And there's a parallel, I think, for our career with Bruce Springsteen's career, in that Sarah and I see ourselves as songwriters and artists that will hopefully carry on through, you know, many, many decades. And each of our records sounds a little different because I think we reflect the era we're living in. We don't necessarily reflect a genre. So I think of ourselves as Bruce Springsteen in that sense. Like, you listen to Ghost of Tom Joad, or you listen to, you know, The River or Nebraska or Born in the USA or more recent work. And I don't think that there's anything necessarily that holds those records together except for Bruce Springsteen himself. And I think that's like Tegan and Sarah.
I think another parallel is
plus
just,
it's a really, you know, great lyric.
It is a great lyric.
And I love that record.
I like you Can't Shut Out the Risk and the Pain. We're all riders on that train, but yeah.
Yeah.
Without losing the love that remains. But anyway, let's just talk about the lyrics of Human Touch line by line for the next half
hour. Totally.
But another parallel is back in the day, back in the Bruce Springsteen, the R.E.M. era, there was this idea that you would, you know, have a bunch of albums that were more for a cult, and then it was a natural thing to go for it. There was always the kind of like, let's go, and like, I'm gesturing a grand slam, but kind of like, you know, the swinging for the fences. And you guys, in that sort of old-fashioned way, have done that. And so what was, I think you've said that one of the things that influenced your thinking was Taylor Swift's move from country to pop.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the thinking behind the move?
I definitely think that there were just albums that became really interesting to us from just a sonic perspective. Alicia Keys, Robin, was listening to a lot of specifically more so than Tegan, was listening to a lot of electronic music and things like really random, like Fortet and Panthe de Prince, like really random stuff. And I was the one that sort of initially wanted to move away from guitars. I sort of wasn't feeling as interested in the production that was happening on indie rock records. But also that sort of coincided with Tegan's desire to change the sort of ambition and goal of the project. And she sort of had felt like we had bought into this idea of like indie rock status and, you know, who cares about pop radio? And, you know, we had sort of done that for about 10 years. And at some point, it almost felt privileged, you know, to say like, oh, we're not going to try to be a bigger band, or we're not going to try to compete with some of our, you know, peers.
The truth is too, is that we felt alone in indie rock. We felt a little alienated. We were queer women, you know, playing in a male dominated industry, in a male dominated genre. And, you know, guitar was an instrument that we learned second. We were classical trained piano players. We learned guitar second, and so it was a songwriting tool. It wasn't my first instrument. I am not a good guitar player. I am a mediocre guitar player, and I felt I was drowning sometimes out there on stage. You know, I wasn't having as much fun. I was so worried about my gear. I was like, guitar and keyboard and timbre and this and that and whatever. And I just, we got to the end of Sainthood, and Sarah wanted to change the sound of the band, and I wanted to change our goal. What's our goal? Our goal is to reach people. We have this incredible community of people that listen to our music. There's got to be more people out there who want to listen to us. And we were like, it wasn't like we were being embraced necessarily by our community at the time. We were sort of outsiders. And I was like, well, if we're going to be outsiders, let's be outsiders on a bigger stage.
People get grossed out by ambitious people too. I mean, especially women. I mean, we're seeing it with the election right now. There's so much suspicion when a woman wants to be big or successful or dominate, you know, whereas with a man, it's just sort of like, yeah, he's the best. Like, you know,
genius.
And I think, you know, for us, we started to be like, whoa, were we trying to like not offend people or push people by sort of making ourselves not seem like we wanted to be successful? And I think there was a time where we were just like, we're really ambitious and we're good at this and we want to be bigger than we are.
It does seem like a time when some boundaries are breaking down. We were talking about the Beyonce Dixie Chicks performance the other night. What did you guys think of that?
I mean, I thought it was really cool. I'm terrified of the internet right now, and I'm terrified of people and awards shows, and it's been a really tough year in that sense. Like, I just feel like no matter who you are and what you do, I mean, Beyonce, please don't come after Beyonce. And like the fact that all the news was just, it's all clickbait, you know, but they're like, everyone goes after Beyonce, you know, on Facebook, you know, because she's at the Country Music Awards. And I just the world's so crazy. I don't know what to believe. I don't know what to buy into, and whatever. From just just for me to click on the video and watch her, I'm just like, she can do no wrong, and I think it's great. And I think we should challenge things. We should take down boundaries. I think all music is sort of coming together and influencing each other right now. And so, just from that standpoint, I was like, yay! But the coverage of it, I just was like, when is the asteroid coming? Can it speed up?
That's actually, you may not know this, that's the official slogan of 2016.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I'm glad that you guys brought up the idea of indie rock being alienating, because I feel like that's used as this tool of authenticity, like the idea that creating indie rock music, creating like guitar driven music somehow makes you a real musician, and you guys went towards this passion of yours, and also felt you felt like you didn't belong in that community.
Pop music's hard. Like, that's the other thing that we should add into that is that, like, we still play all our own instruments and we still write all our own songs. And we still, you know what I mean? Like, there's something, I think pop music got a little diluted and kind of got a little cheesy there for a minute. And I think people started to think that was all pop music, you know? So,
yeah. And it's constantly reinventing, and it's constantly like going with these new waves. And I'm wondering, do you feel more accepted in pop music? And also, how did your fans feel when you did make that transition?
I get confused sometimes, because I think my instinct is always to say I do feel more accepted in pop music, but I also wonder if it's because we're less threatening to the people in pop music. I think that there's more of a legacy of, you know, queer, gender non-conforming, open-minded people in pop music, and whereas like in indie rock there really is like a sort of old guard of like, and there's like certain rules in the rock world that I don't think exist in pop music, especially right now, because what seems to actually be driving a lot of the production right now in pop music is either coming from electronic music, which has a real strong history in queer, you know, like dance music in the 80s and 90s, and then also in hip hop. And I think, you know, because there's so much cross-pollination happening, it's like there's just less rules. People get excited at the idea of you pushing boundaries and being creative. Nobody's like mad at anybody making a pop record that's like,
well, some people are mad, but they're called trolls.
No. I mean, like, nobody's looking at a pop record and going like, well, they broke the cardinal rule. Whereas like with rock music, I felt like we were always breaking rules and we were always doing it wrong. And sometimes that there was really cool things that came out of that, and then there were other times where I was like, I just felt beaten down. Like, we're never going to be taken as seriously as a guy. And so I wanted to, I mean, it didn't scare us away from that music, it just made me feel limited or something. So I and with regards to our fans, I mean, oh my god, our first fan letter in 1998 when we started our email, you know, our first email account was a negative email. I mean, we were like, in 1998. I mean, it's like, people complain, people are mad at you. You can, most of the people are so supportive. Our band
Yeah, what's cool about our band is that, and it's in a pretty loving way, I see it, but like, you know, there's always going to be voices that come out that are like, oh, I don't like this, or I liked this era better, or whatever. Yeah. But there's always this kind of giant wave of positivity that comes, and I hope that that's representative of what I hope we bring to our audience. You know, we try to have a positive only message online, even if it's directing people towards change or organizing and movement in the political forum. And I think that Sarah and I try to make our music feel like a good place. We try to make our shows feel like a community space, and I think that when it comes to criticism online, I hope we're encouraging positive reinforcement. If you don't like this record, that's cool. There's 7 more that you can listen to. You want to come see us play live? No problem. You'll hear 18 old songs. You know, like, we try to always follow up any criticism with some positivity. So,
I want to say that it's one thing to say you guys went pop, but what you actually did was help create a lane in pop, because the particular sound of Heartthrob and now on Love You to Death was really a kind of unique 80s influence thing that some people have argued really was a big influence on 1989, and you may have firsthand knowledge that that's the case. Taylor Swift, 1989, to be clear to listeners, and then also things like Carly Rae Jepsen, etc. But I'm that particular sound with the synths and the certain influences, how did you get there?
I mean, it's so boring, such a boring answer, but I think for both of us, we were working in music programs where those are just like the sounds that are readily available. And
we record in Logic, and when we were demoing, it was like,
we tweak them. You know, I remember even with Sainthood experimenting a lot with keyboards and Moogs and putting them through guitar pedals. Those were the tools that we had. You know, we'd been playing guitar for so long that it made sense to take a keyboard and put it through the same pedal board. And
like, I literally just, for Sainthood pre-production, just took my keyboard out and then just took my giant pedal board out and just ran my keyboard through my pedal board, because I didn't know how to use any of the keyboard knobs. That's what I call it. Like, I just was like, I don't know what any of these do, but I know what these guitar pedals do.
But then those sounds, they do have a throwback feeling to the 80s. And I think that, you know, one thing I will say is that, you know, especially moving forward as a band, I think that we're always looking for a way to not feel nostalgic. Like, I like the idea that we're using influences from the 80s, but I want to make sure that the arrangements and the messaging is progressive and it's moving forward, and you wouldn't mistake it for something that you heard in 1988 or whatever, you know?
Or 1989.
Or 1989, yeah. Or literally on 1989, Taylor Swift's record.
I would like to put here Drove Me Wild, if we can, because I think that... when I hear that, I hear a couple years of pop that followed. Could we play the beginning of that? You carried romance in the palm of your head. You called the place for us. You claimed to suffer strange and follow the plan. You put the price. So, I mean... I have to say, because it struck me, because I was re-listening to the album, I was like, God, that did... People kind of took your ball and ran with it a little bit.
But you know what? That's so exciting. It's so exciting. I mean, I just want to stay on record. You know, we met Taylor Swift before she went and made 1989, and she was a delight. And she made us homemade biscuits and jam and had us come up and play Closer, which was really exciting. And she was very vocal in the press about liking this record, which was very helpful to us. We also worked with Carly Rae Jepsen on her last record. We didn't get a song on the record, but we got to songwrite with her, and it was a delight. She's incredibly talented. She's incredibly... she's just very good. I mean, actually, she's just really good. We toured with Katy Perry. She's a delight as well. She's really nice. All of these women are incredibly intelligent, incredibly articulate about what they want. They're very ambitious. They're great songwriters. And, and all of them gave us props. And I think that when we made Heartthrob, we didn't set out to do anything other than really prove that we could challenge ourselves and reach a bigger audience. And a lot of those artists, when they started to say that they loved the record and give us props, that was really great. It was awesome. But what was most important to us was that we were able to travel around the world, reach more people. We saw no diversity on pop radio when it came to women. We did not see any queer women being represented in the mainstream. And so our goals, like Sarah said, we set out with certain new goals, but we immediately were like, we want to try to change the face of pop music. Even if it ends up not being us and all we did was create a lane, like you said, great. Then I hope a lot of people get
hit on that lane, and hopefully it's we see more diversity out there.
It's really flattering too. Like, I remember hearing after we put out Walking with a Ghost in 2004, you know, I remember hearing stuff that combined acoustic instruments, organic sounds, and like synths, and you know, sort of shouty, more maybe more like masculine sounding female vocals. I remember thinking, oh, I'm hearing this. Is this, did we do this? Or is this just like everybody's on the same wavelength? And I really subscribe to the idea that there's a collective consciousness. I don't even think that people are trying to rip each other off. I think that it's just like, if you're alive, you're influencing and being influenced by a lot of the same things. And so it makes sense that a bunch of us all end up start sounding the same. So, yeah.
So one of the things that fascinates me is that you were doing your kind of indie rock show, and then when you made your shift towards a pop thing, you got a music director, mm-hmm. right? And I'm always fascinated by the general idea of the music director in shows, and so I felt like you guys would have one of the best insights because you have done it kind of both ways, the rock way and the... So what does that do?
I think rock is the only genre that doesn't have musical directors. Yeah. Like,
to be fair,
literally.
Like, just for the record too, like there's... It's not like a one size fits all job either. It's like sort of like production. You know, like when people talk about producers, there's all kinds of producers. There's like there's the guy that comes in and does everything and tells you what to do and whatever. And then there's just like our experience, which has been so collaborative. And a lot of times we use these people, whether it's a musical director or a producer, to just you know, to edit. Like they're somebody who can like have a really zoomed out view of things. So with our musical director, his name is Chris, and we sort of found him through Katy Perry's camp. But what he does for Katy Perry's camp, I'm sure, is unique and very specific to what she needs. And for us, we needed somebody to take 8 albums worth of material and find a cohesive, you know, palette of instrumentation and, you know, and sort of do that in a way where the technology all sort of works together and is able to sort of select from those songs what are the important sort of melodic elements and the instrumentation that is important that we can cover off, and then sort of clean out the tracks and the backing tracks and sort of assess the show in that way. So it's like, you know, it's actually a real skill. It's a real skill.
It's like decluttering in our
world.
And
when we were like, you know, like an indie rock band, first of all, we weren't using any tracks. We weren't using any background vocals. We were just like, okay, there's 5 of us. You take that part, you take this part. Like, you know, it was a really easy thing to do. But as you're sort of starting to build the show, and that this also connects to like what the lighting person does, what the stage manager is doing. You know, we just feel like it's better to hire somebody who can like be looking at the whole thing. And, you know, so it's a very sort of, grown-up way of approaching the show.
Well, but we kind of helpful. In a strange way, we all these years we were the musical director, and we would like painstakingly sit there and listen to the songs and be like, hey, you're gonna play that keyboard hook, can you hear it?
Right.
And it's cool when you have an outsider come in and listen with a fresh set of ears. It's like a director. I mean, they really are kind of listening with a fresh set of ears. And the best thing Chris did for us was just take 60% of what we had been doing and just muted it. He's like, there, you're ready for a live venue. You do not need 80 tracks playing, like you need one. And
also to take our
really
old,
exciting
and to take
he
our
was
old
able
music
to do things that would have taken me
better.
Days to do, like on Walking with a Ghost. I was like, I still want to have that guitar riff off the top, and you know, I was thinking that he could, like, I was like, wouldn't it be cool if it was just sampled and I could just play a sample of an electric guitar on stage? And it's like 5 minutes later, he's like, all right, it's on your cube, you know, it's, we sent it over to you. And I'm like, damn it. Dana. And I was like, great.
It is like modernizing the old music, so we don't just feel like we're up there like old school styles, like, oh, we're a modern pop band. Now let's go back to 2002. Let's see, how do we get the amps out? Like, it's confusing, you know?
Were you scared? Walking with a Ghost, and let's play that for a second. You've revamped it, so let's hear the original for a second.
Everything has sans amp on it. My vocal, everything. They just ran the whole mix through a sans amp. So that guitar riff, you know, comes in a minute here as an electric guitar riff. And all we did was sample it.
Right.
And then we built from there.
And Andy was doing his version of Walking with the Ghost earlier. We won't make him do it.
I'm not going to do it.
Imagine it without a melody.
Yeah.
but I mean, I was imagining listening to what you do with it now, which is, you know, you strip it down and it's kind of keyboard driven. It's totally different. Was that a little scary to take this beloved song and play it? Like, where fans would be like, you know, screw you. Like, we want to hear, you know.
I think the rule out there is as long as they can still sing along, fans enjoy hearing the new versions. What we don't like as an audience member, I think, is when you go and a song becomes not only unrecognizable, but also impossible to follow. And so our rule of thumb when we're rejigging an old song, and this has always been the way we look at it, is that it should still be the sort of the same arrangement, right? You should still be able to wait, like within a few seconds go, oh my God, I know what this is, and then be able to sing along.
It's also, I mean, this
and again, it's decluttering, right? Like some of these songs, like for instance, we reworked a song called Living Room, and this was a song that
I knew she was going to move away from my song. I just want to say one thing about Walking with a Ghost. Just one thing about Walking with a Ghost. Because this is, as the person who wrote it and had to sing it for the last, you know, like 12 years, there is joy, a true visceral joy when the song starts and my little hand doesn't have to do that riff for 2.5 minutes. It's amazing how it just can free you up to be emotionally passionate and present in a song.
Well, and the audience can feel that joy, right? Like, that's the thing. Again, if it's recognizable and it's singable.
I don't
singable,
even care about the audience. I'm just okay, like, well, if they didn't like it, I would be like, I'm doing it this way. Eat shit. Yeah. I'd be like, eat shit. I'm doing
well,
it this
way. Okay, as an outsider, when Sarah starts that song, it's so visceral, Sarah's joy in that moment to be doing something new.
Nice.
You can see the audience react to that. So that's the key, right? You do, again, to bookend this interview with a Bruce Springsteen reference, I think Bruce Springsteen is known for trying to give the audience a really great time, but it's very obvious he's having the best time of his life on stage.
Yeah.
That's why he's playing 2 extra hours than what the average band does. And I think for Sarah and I, that's always been our balancing act. How do we reward our audience for being loyal, for being supportive, for being enthusiastic and coming out and seeing us, but also have a great time on stage? And they need to feel that. You know, you don't sustain a career as long as we have through so many different incarnations and collaborations without looking like you're having a great time and feeling like you're having a good time. They can tell. They know. And I think for Sarah and I, that's what bringing in a musical director or having more of a pop sound or taking a tour that's really out of left field. It's joy. It's capturing that joy and harnessing it and continuing to be Tegan and Sarah for another day.
Absolutely. We asked on Twitter for some fan questions, and a lot of them are just, when are you going to play in my town? So we'll skip those. But Lisa, that's mostly
come to Brazil.
Fans, yeah. Lisa Rocco wanted to know, may seem like an obvious question, but how does it feel when fans sing your songs back at you, which you were talking about?
Pure joy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, well, sometimes actually, okay, here's a real honest answer. Of course it's incredible and it's so amazing.
Sarah's the real curmudgeon today.
No, then. I'm not a curmudgeon. I just feel like it's like, I just don't like to feel like I'm just giving the stock answer. It's like everybody says, of course it's amazing. It's so cool.
But
here's an interesting thing that I've noticed in for a lot of bands is that it's like people don't actually know the words. And I don't know if it's because it's because you're looking at them and their brains get stressed out. But I've noticed this a lot lately. And I notice this because a lot of the songs that people so enthusiastically sing along to are songs that we've stripped down acoustically and they're Tegan songs. So I don't sing through a lot of them. And I watch people in the audience and it's just mayhem. It's like, people are singing the wrong words. They're out
now
of time.
Now people are going to stop singing.
No,
you know
it's
what?
Beautiful. It's a beautiful.
Don't listen to Sarah, you guys. Sing with your full heart.
It's a beautiful collective moment, but then it makes me wonder, like, am I able to sing my favorite songs in a live setting properly? Like, and I found it really, really, it's an interesting collective phenomenon that I've noticed a lot lately. Some people get it and they'll get like the right, they'll get like the pre-chorus. They'll like nail it and then we'll launch into the chorus and I'm like, no one knows what they're doing here. This is a disaster.
And in our remaining minute, what are you thinking next? Because you've done the pop revamp, but like, and
I don't know, but if you have any ideas, throw them out because we're not sure.
Sort of like a Mumford and Sons.
I think that
metal.
I mean, we haven't done metal yet.
We're kind of in a weird place where it's like, you know, there's a couple tracks out there right now, like where some people are on the like they'll just drop songs all the time, and then there's other people who are being traditional about wanting to still make records. It's funny when you get to 8 records, like this is something we've seen from a lot of big iconic artists, is that they put out records that people just know they just don't connect to as much as the older music. And I think Sarah and I, that's part of revitalizing Tegan and Sarah every few years, is that we don't want to become irrelevant, you know. We want to make sure that we're tapped into what people want. So I don't think we have an answer, but what comes next sucks for Tegan and Sarah, but I think when it does happen, it will hopefully be what the audience wants. You know, ultimately we want to feel that that connection with the Tegan and Sarah, you know, community.
That makes sense.
So yeah, Mumford and Sons probably.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Like a combo between them and Coldplay. A little Beyonce on top. It's going to be great.
Tegan and Sarah, thank you so much for being here. That was so fun.
It's our pleasure. Thanks for having us.
We'll be back with more Rolling Stone Music Now and an interview with vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I wanted to talk a little bit about music in this election. It's sort of like talking about like literally the soundtrack to the apocalypse, but so it's, it may seem a little trivial. But you know, what do you guys think of the way that Hillary in particular has or has not used pop culture and pop music? My feeling is that she has not used it as well as Obama has, but as Obama did in his campaigns. But what do you guys think?
I mean, I feel like it's more so the people coming to her, whereas Obama was very vocal about his favorite music and bringing in these musicians to, you know, campaign with him or work with him. And I feel like a lot of pop stars have flocked to Hillary, like Katy Perry has been probably the most vocal supporter in the pop world for her and has campaigned with her. So I feel like it's just sort of like a secondary thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is sort of the first election in a long time where the classic rock world, they weren't really like campaigning with the Democrat. It's usually John Mellencamp and John Fogerty and Bruce Springsteen at these rallies. Like, that's back to Al Gore and Kerry and Obama twice.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were talking before the show. I mean, one aspect of this is that those aren't the voters maybe that Hillary needs or is going after. That it's a different candidate in a different world. I think she may have ceded some of those voters to Trump, and what she's trying to do is energize a whole different part of the electorate.
Right.
So different artists, different world.
Yeah. I mean, in the final days of Kerry in 04 and Obama in 08 and Obama in 12, it was Bruce Springsteen at the last three or four rallies, and that's not happening now, it seems like.
And now, reportedly, it might be Beyonce.
Right.
Which is, you know, listen, the number one get in music. It's interesting. I mean, what impact do you guys think that will have, Beyonce?
I mean, I think that a lot of people were really judgmental when Hillary was like, I love Lemonade, because they felt like it was sort of pandering to her millennial voters and was like very buzzy thing for her to say. But I think this will be really great for both the pop world and the political world to combine in that way, and to have Beyonce, who is the biggest artist, you know, right now, but yeah, to have her do that.
Yeah, it will get wall-to-wall news. It will be on all three networks live, probably. So it's just a good way in the final day of the campaign to bring out the biggest possible guns and just really just go for it.
If indeed it happens.
Yeah, if indeed it happens.
What should she play?
Oh, God. Sorry. Crazy in Love with Hillary.
Yeah, it was Jay-Z at the... It was Jay-Z and Bruce Springsteen for Obama in 2012.
Right,
so
right.
I wonder if he'll be there, too.
I think, you know, so I mean, Springsteen in particular, and the reason we keep coming back to him in this context is that he was kind of the big get for the Obama... And you know, and with Kerry, he told me that he hadn't been asked to perform with Hillary. Now that Salon reported that he has been asked, but there's still no sign of him. We'll see. I mean, that still might happen. I'm convinced that maybe Hillary, that's just not who Hillary is going after.
Right.
That's why he hasn't asked. The
clock is really ticking. There's Saturday and Sunday and Monday. You know, this is virtually over. So
yeah, Hillary saying she liked Lemonade also raised a lot of questions given the subject matter. So it's somewhat awkward. It feels like they told her to say she liked it, but maybe she should have named a prior album or or just talked about the key changes on Love on Top, or just like
a huge fan of B-Day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she should have gotten deep. But it was also, I also think some of it is that a lot of the enthusiasm was with Bernie, mm-hmm. in the sort of musical community, and then it took a while to shift over.
Yeah, I feel like classic rock's place has been a lot of artists were super supportive of Bernie, and then also it's been like a huge pushback with Trump using so many songs, and then a lot of these artists being like, please no.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's funny that there is one. I'm sure there's other ones, but the only one that Kid Rock was just like standing out there alone being like, Trump. It's like a voice in the musical wilderness.
No. And I think the part of it, there were months and months in which Hillary seemed to have this just in the bag, right? She was up by 10 points.
Sure.
That she didn't need that last push, but now that it's tightening, there may be more of an effort to please get Beyonce as soon as possible. We need Beyonce.
And then on to Tim Kaine, who we'll be hearing from in a minute. He is not just a music fan. He should be working at Rolling Stone, possibly.
It was really surprising when they told me I'd be talking to him about his five favorite bands. I was surprised at even that. Then they emailed me the list, and I go, wait, he lists Corner Shop? It's a 90s Britpop band that's really obscure in this country. And I knew that he liked the Replacements. But when he got on the phone with me and started really talking about them as a passionate fan, it was quoting the lyrics to the songs and everything, it was astounding. I mean, he's a real music nut.
Yeah, it's interesting because he seemed a lot more confident and happy talking to you than he did in the vice presidential debate. So maybe it should have been like just a music trivia contest. He would have destroyed Pence.
Yeah, he would definitely win. He was able to quote "Bastards of Young" by the Replacements just off the dome, which is crazy.
What do you think, Hillary? Do you think Hillary is a music fan?
She likes Adele.
Yeah.
She
went to the concert,
vocal.
Right?
She went to the concert. And she also, she's mentioned a lot of like Motown. I know Stevie Wonder just saying happy birthday to her. Yeah. So she has a lot of those.
I saw Bill and Hillary when U2 played at the Garden about a year ago. Mm. And I was watching her the entire night. I was just sort of fascinated by her watching U2.
Creepy, Andy. Yeah.
She was behind me. I just kept turning around. And she didn't really stand till the very end, but she seemed engaged by it.
What song did she respond to most passionately?
I think both the Blue Skies, she stood up.
Huh.
I swear to God.
So, because that's the one about U.S. intervention in Latin America. So interesting. Maybe
it was surprising.
This is for those who are worried that Hillary is too hawkish.
She supports both the Blue Sky.
Yeah, she was like, play the guitar, Ed. She was just like,
play the blues.
Yeah, fascinating. So in a minute, we are going to play an interview that Andy Green conducted with Senator Tim Kaine about Kaine's incredibly detailed and geeky music tastes. It seems like it was a really good conversation, right, Annie?
Yeah, it was fun talking to him. I mean, I just can't imagine that Joe Biden or like Hannibal Hamlin or past vice presidents would have this much interest in modern music. I mean, it was bizarre.
So the first question that Andy asked him was, what is the role of music in your day-to-day life? And here's what Tim had to say.
Music is one of my three great sources of relaxation. So it's music, it's the outdoors, and it's reading. So I listen to music a lot. I've got all my songs downloaded on my smartphone. I listen to music a lot, but I also really enjoy playing music. So, I play the harmonica and carry six harmonicas with me in my briefcase, and I end up playing a lot of music. As a statewide candidate, when I was running for governor, I started to play with bluegrass bands around Virginia because we have so many music festivals. And then once people, saw that I would do it, even though I'm not great, they were like, well, yeah, come on up for a song. So I have, I play a lot of music, I listen to a lot of music, and the part of the day that I look forward to the most is usually when we're heading home from our last event. Like yesterday, we finished up at 10 o'clock a dinner in St. Louis, and then we're going to fly back to Richmond, and we get on the campaign plane and plug in a speaker, and then everybody takes turns trying to impress each other with some song that we want everybody to hear, and it's just a way to really unwind and enjoy ourselves.
Cool. So I want to talk to you about the five artists that you picked for your five favorites.
It was hard to pick five. I wish you'd asked me for 20.
Oh, sorry.
But five is tough.
Well, it's a cool list, so just I want to start on the Replacements. Can you tell me how you discovered them?
yeah, let me think about that. When was the first time I heard a Replacements tune? I think the first album of theirs that I heard was Hootenanny. Mm-hmm. And I can't exactly remember how I got it, but that wasn't their first album. I think that might have been their second album. But mm-hmm. I really loved that album. The combination of really good songwriting and kind of an endearingly amateurish quality to some of the way they do stuff, I really loved. And so became a huge fan of theirs. Never saw them in concert. But pretty much all the albums after Hootenanny I have, and I think Paul Westerberg is a great songwriter, and the guys have just a really unique ability to do good music with lyrics that are really meaningful. And I just read there's a really good kind of a story of the band called Trouble Boys that's come out. A writer named Bob Mehr, M-E-H-R, I think writes for the Memphis newspaper, just did a book about the Replacements.
Oh, yeah.
One of my sons and I are trading around because one of my kids is a huge Replacements fan too. He actually lives in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
So they have always been, really since they started putting out those albums in the 80s, they've been a huge favorite of mine.
Yeah, I just love Paul's singing voice. He's one of my favorite singers of all time, really.
Yeah.
Genius.
And, you know, just lyrically, they're so fantastic that I was listening to Bastards of Young the other day. The ones who love us best are the ones we'll lay to rest and visit their graves on holidays at best. The ones who love us least are the ones we'll die to please. If it's any consolation, I can't begin to understand. I mean, he just really writes very, very good lyrics.
Right, and the whole group was so brief. They were one of those groups that just burned bright and just burned out. It was this little flash
yeah,
of genius.
Yeah. And that book about them is a sad book. I mean, it's right. A cool book because it tells you the story about particular songs, but they all had their own demons from
right.
How they came up, and then they had their own, you know, challenges together. But you know, they're a great story of people who had a creative synergy where they were, the whole was greater than the sum of the parts, and they just really made great music.
Right. All right. I want to talk about the Carter family now. So, what do they appeal to you?
Yeah, when I was a kid in Kansas City growing up, a friend of mine who was a pretty good guitar player, and I was playing the harmonica, played the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band album, Will the Circle Be Unbroken, for me once.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that album. I hadn't heard any kind of bluegrass or mountain music growing up when I did. And many of the songs on that album are Carter family songs, including the title track, obviously. And I started to kind of get into the Carter family. Of course, I had no connection with Virginia then. I was a Midwesterner. But when I met a Virginian from the Appalachian part of our state, my wife Ann, in law school, and then we moved back to Virginia, that the fascination with mountain and bluegrass music really took hold, because there's so many festivals here, and the Carter family all came out of Scott County, Virginia, down near Bristol, and they have this thing called the Carter Fold, which is their farm where they still have a really cool music venue that's kind of a converted barn, and they have great musical performances. So over the years, I've gone to the Carter Fold a couple of times, and as I say, spend a lot of time playing bluegrass. So many of the great bluegrass tunes are either Carter family tunes or tunes that the Carters found from others. They were great, you know, kind of like musical archivists, especially Mother Maybelle, because she learned to play guitar in this really interesting style. And so they, you know, they just collected great music, and they play a lot of great tunes. Some of their melodies have become other people's tunes, like Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land is based on a Carter family's tune. So
right.
I just think that's kind of like the foundation of mountain and bluegrass music, and almost everything traces back to the Carters in one way or the other. And I play a lot of Carter family music on the harmonica and with bluegrass bands everywhere.
All right. How about Dave Matthews Band?
You know, they're a favorite for a lot of reasons. Their musicianship is just amazing. And I actually was with Dave yesterday. He did a concert for our ticket in Denver. And I've gotten to know Dave pretty well over the years, and especially Boyd Tinsley, who's the violin player for the band. As you know, they formed and really came to prominence in Charlottesville, and most of the band still lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just their combination of an unusual instrumentation for a rock band, fantastic musicianship, Dave is a great writer and a great singer, They just always do things that, you know, will really interest you. He's also written some great political music, even though it's not that it's not kind of super sledgehammer. It's not didactic, but he does a lot of tunes that have really good political. He does really, you know, intimate love tunes. He does songs about mental illness. I mean, he really has a breadth as a songwriter that I think is pretty astounding.
Yeah. I was most surprised to see Corner Shop on your list. So tell me about how you first heard them.
Yeah, you know, I was reading a Rolling Stone sometime in the mid-90s, and they had a review of their album, When I Was Born for the Seventh Time. And I got it, and then, you know, have just proceeded to buy virtually everything they produce. They're kind of odd. They will go years without producing anything. They don't really tour very much. I've never seen them. I would love to see them sometime, but the number of live shows they do is very small. But the mixture, I don't know exactly what you would call them. I mean, it's kind of a mixture of you know, Indian Bollywood music and hip hop and you know, kind of funk music. They're a very unique band, and I really like that Tejinder Singh, the main guy's voice. I like the songs that he writes. And it was probably, I don't know, 95 or 96 that I first heard their music, but I really, really enjoy them.
Yeah, and to most Americans, they're totally unknown. I mean, they're really obscure here, so.
Yeah, I don't know that they've ever come to the United States to perform. I mean, I will go on their website on occasion just to see if they are coming over here to perform.
Mm-hmm.
But they do so few live shows.
Right.
So they're kind of, I don't know, they're kind of perfectionists that they're, you know, they're really focused on, they do what they want when they want it, but they're working on their own plan and their own time schedule. They're definitely not working on a commercial time schedule.
Yeah, and the fusion of genres is so unique. I have never heard a band quite like that before. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, the first time I heard that song, Wog, which is off, I think, Woman's Gotta Have It. It's the album mm-hmm. before When I Was Born for the Seventh Time. I just thought, these guys are just doing something that I've not heard anybody else do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they do some interesting covers. They've done a great cover of a wonderful Kink song, Waterloo Sunset. They did the cover of Norwegian Wood sung in Hindi, which mm-hmm. is just a spectacular, very true to the Norwegian Wood, except that it's sung in Hindi. But that, you know, they do some great covers, but their original music is, you know, again, always got something surprising, something that you haven't heard before.
Great, and I want to end on Charlie Parker.
Yeah, I'm a huge traditional jazz fan, so I love jazz music, but especially traditional jazz, and, you know, I would go Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Chet Baker, Sonny Rollins, Dizzy Gillespie, kind of those guys. But Parker, I grew up in Kansas City, and so the Kansas City jazz scene was something that, you know, you become aware of pretty early. And Parker's, you know, commitment to, I hear music this particular way. And, you know, he was not thought in Kansas City as a very good musician because he just kind of kept wanting to do something different than everybody else. And his you know, endless work to kind of come up with what became the bop style of jazz was really revolutionary. And, you know, he was like, this is the way I hear it, and whether you like it or not, this is the way I'm going to play it. Very tragic life, obviously, but his commitment to his own sound was really strong, and I have a huge admiration for him. And I just his music still today is very, very unique. And he also was not just a good player, but he was a really good composer. So a lot of his songs, like Relaxing at Camarillo, or, you know, some of the others, Cool Blues, Hot Blues, many other musicians perform them, and when they do, you can see that the guy wasn't just a great sax player, he was also a really good writer.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that he died at just 34. I mean, he was so young,
yeah.
So it was also brief. It's really amazing.
Yeah, but really had a huge influence that still is really felt in jazz and in other musical forms, too. I don't know that you would have a Jimi Hendrix if you hadn't had bop jazz. That style of playing, I think, had a lot of influence on rock styles too. And you know, jazz and you know, bluegrass are the two, I think, the two great American music forms, and I would, you know, I'd put Charlie Parker right at the top.
Oh, great. I think that should do it, Senator. So thank you so much. It was an honor speaking with you, and
yeah,
this was
great. Yeah, I'm glad we could do it. So tell me something fun you're working on right now. Are you, you know, you following a particular group or seeing a good show recently? Give me something I ought to be listening to.
I'm doing a story on this Desert Trip Festival that was just in California that was Paul McCartney and the Stones and the Who,
yeah,
and Bob Dylan. Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
I was out there in L.A. and San Francisco over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go out to see the show, but a lot of people that I was meeting had been out for part of it.
Yeah.
It sounded like pretty special.
Oh, yeah, and like Bob Dylan's set was amazing. He played songs that he hadn't played in decades, and it was really incredible.
And were they playing with each other? So did like Neil Young play with Bob Dylan and the different groups kind of doing a little bit of that?
It was only Neil and Paul McCartney. They played A Day in the Life, which was pretty sensational.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, good.
All
listen,
right.
Good to talk.
Yeah, it was fantastic. So thank you so much, Senator, and take care.
Okay, thanks, Andy.
Bye.
See ya.
So that was Senator Tim Kaine and non-Senator Andy Green.
Yes.
Talking about music. And I love that you told him about Bob Dylan's set list at Desert Trip, and he seemed pretty interested in it, actually.
Yeah, that was pretty weird. And the guys in Corner Shop, they were very excited about this. This is a huge part of their Twitter now, and on their website, that they are so thrilled. I mean, this is the most attention they've gotten in the States, but possibly ever.
They had a very big hit. I don't think that's true.
Small hit in the States.
It was on the, anyway. This could be on our new show, Distinctions Without a Difference,
that's
where
right.
We argue about things that don't matter at all. Yes.
Yes. I don't think they had like a top 40 hit in the States.
It was.
I mean, I can check.
It was on a lot.
Like alternative radio, not any mainstream.
Alternative radio was very important back then. It was a different time.
Yeah, that is
anyway,
true.
Anyway, important stuff. We had a great show today. We had Tegan and Sarah on, who were delightful. And then we had this Tim Kaine interview. So that's going to be it for this week. See you next week.